Hi, this is TJ Murphy, editor of Lava Magazine. Thank you for joining me. Today, the subject of our podcast is personalized nutrition. Personalized nutrition is a very welcome phrase in the world of triathlon, not to mention the world of health and fitness and health and nutrition, where for years and decades, folks like you and I have been caught in so many different discussions and heated arguments about what is the best form of nutrition. And the answer, the best working answer is that there is no one size fits all diet that's going to be best for everybody. And a foremost thought leader on this entire subject is New York Times bestselling author Rob Wolf. And his website is robwolf.com. His newest book is called Wired to Eat. His first book is called The Paleo Solution. Rob has been sort of labeled the paleo guy. I think a better characterization is that he is a biochemist with extensive coaching and nutrition experience, personal experience, and also teaching experience, and is able to connect the dots between evolutionary biology and how we are wired to eat and why that is such a problem in this age where the supermarket is full of tens of thousands of foods that have been made to kind of pull on our cravings. And not just in a marketing sort of way, but also actually in a physiological way, and why that makes eating well really difficult. But it also takes out all of this religious intensity when it comes to talking about nutrition, and that Rob's primary sort of tool that he advocates is that we on an individual basis, figure out what works best for us. In other words, we go through a process where we figure out what are the right foods for us and what are the foods that might be causing us trouble. And that could be really deep trouble, or it could even be relatively minor trouble when we're talking about just achieving optimal athletic performance. Before we go to the interview, I want to take a moment to mention that this particular episode of the Lava Podcast is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps triathletes get lower rates on their life insurance. If you go to healthiq.com/lava, you can support the show and also see if you qualify. And I'd actually like to take a moment to just talk about life insurance from my own personal experience, and perhaps you've had this experience as well. But if you are someone who actually practices a health and fitness lifestyle, you're a triathlete or you're a runner, or simply maybe you just eat well and perform some sort of a daily exercise routine and things like that, it's pretty odd that the standard sort of protocol where you go through the tests and questionnaires and such to be evaluated for a policy generally doesn't take any of that health and fitness stuff into account. That was my experience. And in fact, one of the things I thought was super weird was that to calculate my sort of my core sort of health and fitness state, they did a BMI test of basically taking my height and my weight and calculating something from that. They didn't take into account that my lean muscle mass or my body fat percentage, which I can talk for hours about why that's the criteria you really want to look at. That lean muscle mass is really the largest endocrine organ in the body, and it's just, if you just take height and weight, you're not really getting a picture of that at all. And so I thought that was pretty odd, and it actually worked against me at the time, because I was doing quite a bit of CrossFit, and I had my lean muscle mass was fairly substantial, and my body fat percentage was pretty low. So that's what's kind of cool about Health IQ, is that they, on your behalf, will communicate that with an insurance carrier to get you a better rate, and their numbers are pretty good. By the way, go to the landing page to read all about it. But is 33% of their. So here, for example, the numbers, 56% of Health IQ customers save between 4 to 33% on their life insurance. And Health IQ can save their customers up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes, which all makes common sense to me. But if you've gone through the standard life insurance evaluation process, it just doesn't seem to be taken into a specific account. So like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, Health IQ saves you money on your life insurance for living a health conscious lifestyle. So again, go to healthiq.com/lava for more information, or if you talk to an Health IQ agent, use the promo code LAVA when you speak with them. So now, please enjoy my conversation with Rob Wolf, a super smart guy. Both of his books are great, Wired to Eat and Paleo Solution. There's a lot to learn about how to personalize your nutrition, whether it's for health and fitness, longevity, or if it's for enhancing performance. Hi, this is TJ Murphy. Thanks for joining us. As I mentioned in the preview here, my guest today is Rob Wolf. He's a New York Times bestselling author. He's out with his second book. His first book was called The Paleo Solution. But his history is much broader and deeper than just talking about the Paleolithic diet, which he's certainly become a thought leader on. But he has been an advisor to special forces like the Navy SEAL community, and he's also been a strength and conditioning thought leader, opening up the first CrossFit affiliate. And he's also, Rob, you've become kind of a master of jiu-jitsu.
Not remotely a master. Absolutely not. I'm still the guy that everybody else uses to clean the mat with. So no, that's a lie.
But I
keep getting a little better. I keep getting a little better. Yeah.
Well, we'll chat about this shortly, because I think it's an important point that you make in your new book. And the new book, I should mention, is called Wired to Eat. And let me get the tagline right here as well. Turn off cravings, rewire your appetite for weight loss, and determine the foods that work for you. And you can find out more about the book and Rob's podcast at robwolf.com, and I'll have that in the show notes along with a link to the book. But I also want to mention that you've got your early background was as a biochemist, research biochemist, and I think some of the roots are there. But you've been an explorer, and I think one of the things I just want to start off with a comment about your new book, Wired to Eat, and that is that I'm reading it, and I've read my share of diet books and training books and all sorts of nonfiction how-to books, but yours is definitely in a league of someone who thought deeply about it before they started writing it. And in other words, there's unfortunately so much weird controversy that comes up with the subject of diet, whether you're talking with athletes, triathletes, the person at the supermarket that you bump into, friends, family. It almost has a weird religious sort of intensity to it. And what you've done a really good job of is that you found a language that was sincere. Like I feel like you're a guy that sees what's going on with the obesity epidemic in the United States and beyond, and you have gained some solid understanding of how to help folks, get themselves out of this mess or to begin dealing with it. And you found a language and tone and way to kind of talk about the science and talk about evolutionary biology, but a way that first of all, it takes the reader off the hook, and I guess that's the first thing that I want to talk about, and that is the morality that is involved with people that are overweight. And one of your core messages is, hey, it's not your fault that you are up against a system beyond all systems that that when you walk through a supermarket, there's been a lot of money invested to get you to eat a certain way. And a comment that you've made is that if you're not fat, if you're not suffering from some of these problems like type 2 diabetes and sleep loss and things like that, you're a little weird.
You're kind of, from an evolutionary biology perspective, you're kind of screwing up. Like your ancient ancestors are kind of doing a collective facepalm kind of thing, because they're like, dude, you should be eating more and moving less, not running around like a mad person and, you know, weighing and measuring your food. Yeah, I mean, it sounds kind of crazy. And, you know, it's interesting because on the coaching side of things, I've had a few folks that reached out to me and they articulated essentially the following. Hey, Rob, I was reading the book, I was enjoying it, but then I got to that whole it's not your fault piece. Mm-hmm. And it really rubbed these coaches the wrong way initially, because they felt like I was kind of doing some sort of like a fat acceptance deal or something like that. I'm not doing that at all. I don't mm-hmm. suggest that we just roll over and expose our fleshy underbelly to the ravages of the world and just give up. But there is kind of a reality, you know, if somebody, is telling you, hey, I would really like to run, but I've got this problem with my foot. And you're like, well, what's the problem? And they have like a nail stuck through their foot. It's kind of like, whoa, okay, let's deal with that. Like that's a legit problem. Like where, you know, the person's not being weak-willed. They're not morally flawed or anything. And similarly, the way that we are fundamentally genetically wired is to eat more, move less. The notion of moderation just has absolutely no context within this kind of ancestral health environment. And there are very few people out there who can navigate, you know, eating 1/5 of a Twinkie and then wrapping it back up and sticking it back in the cupboard. And they're mega disciplined. And yeah. Those people oftentimes also end up having, you know, a whole wardrobe of suits and dresses made out of human skins. Like they're just crazy people. So it's not the average person, and it is definitely not, you know, reflected in this meme of eat less, move more, everything in moderation. It is just wantonly failing the rest of society. You know, all of westernized culture, this seems to be the story that we're told, and it just fails again and again because it fundamentally ignores our evolutionary biology.
Yeah, and this applies to folks that have taken up athletics as well. And I speak from I've been a triathlete and a runner since the early 1980s. And I came to a point where it just seemed like it seemed like the training I was doing, which became harder and harder because I kept getting injured, barely kept the weight off. And mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, during a period of time where I'd throw my back out and my traditional sports science proven high carb diet was what I was eating. And, you know, I was absolutely sick. And there's a certain point where you go, you know, I have to question my beliefs here, because I started picking up on things from folks like Brian McKenzie and yourself and things that I had weird emotional reactions to. I'm like, you know, they're wrong. I know they're wrong because I had such success in 1992 with the way I ate.
right.
But then, you know, it's interesting. I later on interviewed Dr. John Ivey at the University of Texas, who does a lot of really great stuff in sports nutrition research. And he was telling me about some data that he'd picked up where he had a group of master's age athletes, runners and triathletes. And if you took their training away from them for a couple of days because they were eating kind of their traditional high carb diet, they immediately sort of showed signs for being type 2 pre-diabetic, sort of. Mm-hmm. I mean, like immediately. It was like within a week they were just showing that they were genetically predisposed toward diabetes, especially, and by eating with the way they're eating, they were just inflaming that entire problem. So I think that your point, so I can imagine why coaches might at first have that reaction, but it's not just everyday moms and dads out there that are It's even folks that are working really hard, going to the gym and running. And Dr. Tim Noakes, author of The Lore of Running, the professor in South Africa, who he's a guy that has completely kind of flipped his thinking on this whole subject with, you know, how we should be eating as athletes or non-athletes. He did a study on some half marathons in Cape Town, and he's like, all these people are running a half marathon, yet most of the people in the field, if you did a body composition test, were fat. So what's wrong with that? You know, what's going on there that we're not talking about, and why are we not talking about it?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and I'm still you know, so you brought up the jujitsu. I'm still trying to crack the nut of fully keto fueled grappling and mixed martial arts. And there's a few people out there that are claiming that they've kind of cracked the nut. And part of what they're doing is a targeted ketogenic approach where right before the training session, the person will take as little as like 5 or 10 grams of something like a maltodextrin, or as much as 50 grams of, again, something like maltodextrin. And they throw it in immediately prior to the training session. And, you know, the theory with that is that the exercise is going to blunt the need for insulin release. And so it's kind of this sweet spot where you're able to use some carbs to get a little extra pop. But you're minimizing kind of the insulin, all that. But I think it's becoming really clear that at least on some sort of a sliding scale, there are a lot of people who do better at a lower carbohydrate intake. And, you know, we look further afield and you look at like the Kenyans who eat a very high carb intake and some other, you know, folks that have traditionally been pretty successful. But what's interesting to me is, in these westernized populations that have potentially been on antibiotics a lot, that eat food that may have been exposed to antibiotics a lot, some other things that may be mitochondrial disruptors like NSAIDs and a whole host of different pharmaceuticals, for our Western population, it may be almost a self-defense mechanism that we need to eat at the lower carb side of things to be healthier. And this is super theoretical. There's no randomized control trial, you know, illustrating this stuff. There's some mechanistic papers that I could build potentially a compelling case around this. But it is interesting that, you know, we can look out at the world and we can definitely see examples of higher carb consuming healthy populations. We also see some very low carb consuming healthy populations. But once we start getting that westernization of the food supply and westernization of the lifestyle and all those other epigenetic inputs, like potentially antibiotics and you know, like non-vaginal birth, not breastfed, formula instead of breastfeeding, you know, on and on and on, all these different things appear to have some really important impact on the gut flora, which has knock-on effects in our inflammation, which dramatically influences our insulin sensitivity. And so it's a devilishly complex problem if you're trying to explain exactly why all of this is happening. It's a fairly easy problem to solve if you get in and just do a little bit of clinical tinkering. You know, you play with a lower end of the carbohydrate spectrum and you titrate it up a little bit and you kind of play with some types as well as the amounts. And it doesn't take a huge amount of effort to find a pretty good optimum for folks, so long as they're not so ideologically wed to a specific methodology that they're incapable of just trying on that different sweater and giving it a shot.
Yeah. And I think that's, you make an important point that is obviously part of the message of your book, and that is we're sort of in this era where personalized nutrition is a good way to go about this. We've got better tools to sort of find out how we're responding to certain things via, for example, blood testing that you can find on from companies like Inside Tracker and Wellness FX, and or working with your doctor, or to quote Dr. Ken Ford on this, find a good doctor. Be ready to fire the doctor you have. You want somebody you can work with. But it's not why feel like you have to sort of wave the flag of be it the zone diet or the ketogenic diet or whatnot, it might be a better route. And Peter Attia has talked about this to a degree too, that it's about finding what works for you, what's most optimal for you. And your book obviously has tools to sort of do that. And I thought Attia had some great comments on it. And this is, it was a podcast with Ken Ford on the IHMC STEM Talk podcast. But, Peter definitely helped put this current sort of conversation that's really sort of heating up on the ketogenic diet through his blog, eatingacademy.com. But in the discussion with Ken, he was saying that in his clinical practice, he was kind of backing away from that, that he didn't come in charging with a 50 grams of carb or less per day sort of protocol. Rather, he wanted to kind of see what their blood was telling him. And so his point was that, for a lot of folks, particularly those that are predisposed to being resistant to carbohydrate, a ketogenic diet can work quite fine, but he's also seen certain folks where that has just gone off the rails. And Kirk Parsley said one of the same things to me. Kirk said, "Yeah, I've seen some folks on a ketogenic diet, and it's just a shit show." To quote
right,
it directly,
right, right.
But then you back them off, to 100 carbs, 100 grams of carbs per day, and what those carbs are. I think that's another point that you make, right, and Peter Attia makes. And then you can start maybe find some things where you're feeling better, you're sleeping better, and things start lining up. And I that seems to me like that's kind of like a mission for you. To get back to the tone and the way you've written the book, if you could just talk about how did you approach this? I do feel like you did some hard thinking about how do I write another book that gets into this subject that communicates the way I want it to communicate. Can you give me a little background on that?
Yeah. So here's a little bit of my naivete with the first book. When I sent them to the publisher, I pressed enter, I looked at my wife and I said, "Okay, we need to find out what the next career is." And not because it was going to sell more copies than Harry Potter, but because I was, foolish enough and thinking that this was going to solve everybody's problem everywhere. Just the basic paleo diet concept had a lot of challenges, not so much with the methodology, but with the perception. Mm-hmm. People would immediately dismiss it. This caveman reenactment thing. Right. Did any of these people actually read any of the research on the topic? Oh, of course not. But, they would form these really strongly held opinions. But then on the flip side of that, folks who did do the paleo diet and had really wonderful success with it, they literally turned it into a religious process. And they turned it into a process of asking constantly, is this food paleo, instead of asking, is this a good option for me? And so there were some real challenges there. And so that was kind of one piece of the story. But at the same time, 5 years ago, almost 6 years ago now, my family, my wife and I at this time, and the in utero to be born daughter moved to Reno, Nevada. And I was here in town maybe 3 weeks, and a guy named Greeny reached out to me, a phone call. And he said, "Hey, I'm part of a clinic here in town. I'd like you to see what we're doing." And Greeny ended up being a guy named Dr. Jim Greenwald, who's a now retired but formerly pretty famous orthopedic surgeon. And he was part of a risk assessment program that had found 30. They were working with the Reno police, Reno Fire Department. They found 35 people at high risk for type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, got these folks on a lowish carb paleo diet, modified their sleep and exercise as best they could. And based off their changes in blood work and health risk assessment parameters, it's estimated the pilot study alone saved the city of Reno about $22 million uh-huh. prorated over a 10-year period mm-hmm. with a 33-to-1 return on investment. So, I was looking at this, and it was just kind of crazy when I walked in this clinic, because they had Gary Taub's books and my books and Lauren Cordain's books, and usually mainstream established medical clinics, they like to box all of our books up and take them out and burn them, not sell them in the clinic and give them away to people. But I was looking at that and I'm like, damn, this stuff is really, really powerful. It's no joke powerful. It is you know, that ancestral health template as a way of looking at asking the questions, like the hypothesis generation. It doesn't give you answers particularly well. That's where you can get into the caveman reenactment story. But when you want to start asking questions about human health and performance, it's a beautiful place, and I would say the place to start. So, you know, I had these kind of conflicting things going on, where on the one hand, the paleo diet had this kind of like image and PR and marketing problem just because of its inherent nature and because people can be absolute knuckleheads and not take the time to do any due diligence on stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there was also the reality that people tended to take this paleo concept and kind of turn it into religious doctrine. But then at the same time, we had this really wonderfully done clinical intervention that showed that it could be incredibly powerful for a host of different conditions. So I was kind of left with how to tackle that. And I had been fiddling with, you know, collecting research and fiddling with an outline, I don't know, for about 3 years. And then I ran across a paper that talked about human brain evolution and the omnivore's real dilemma. And I actually did a PaleoFX talk on this about 3, maybe 4 years ago, I guess, 3 years ago. And this thing just blew my hair back. It was really amazing. And this is really where I got that sense of it's not your fault. If you live in this modern world of hyperpalatable foods, you should not be the least bit surprised that it's really difficult to decouple yourself from that process. So that was a big important piece. I had a way of tackling this information from more the emotional morality kind of position. And you could talk, you know, I talk a ton about mechanism of biochemistry and endocrinology and digestion, like all that's in there still because it's all important. But at the end of the day, the feedback that I had from just, I mean, literally thousands of people, when they would have a modicum of success changing their diet and lifestyle, and then they would spin out and kind of, you know, just quit. And talking, the common message was that, wow, this was way harder than what I thought it was going to be. I feel like a failure. I see people around me, either in real life or particularly on social media. I see these people who seem to be doing this effortlessly. There must be something wrong with me. I'm a big failure. And you know, the person may have lost 50 pounds, but then they do some, like, you know, compare and contrast, and they find themselves lacking, and then they just peel out, and it's pizza and beer and ice cream again, you know. And so I was noodling on that, and this story around the morality piece really, you know, I was like, oh, okay, this is what's going on with people. So I had that story on the front end of this whole thing. But then as time went along, it also has become more and more clear that, you know, you can throw a message out like paleo or low carb or macrobiotic or vegan or what have you. And if you have a bell curve distribution of a population, there's going to be a certain frequency band that information fits the needs of the folks in that population really, really well. And then as you start getting more standard deviations out, it fits the needs of that population less and less well, which kind of implied the need for some significant customization. You know, you can never really go wrong with the basic recommendation of eat largely whole, unprocessed foods. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, okay, no, nobody would argue about that. But my wife and I just completed some kind of quantified self-testing where I ate a battery of foods and checked my blood glucose response, and she ate the battery of the same foods and checked her blood glucose response. And, you know, bless her little pancreas, but man, she can just kick my ass up one side and down the other on blood glucose response, you know. And so this you know, very common sense Mark Twain-esque, you know, thing of eat whole, unprocessed foods, that's great. And for my wife, that could include rice, and it could include white potatoes, and not insignificant amounts. But for me, if I ate the same amounts and the same types of carbs that my wife eats, my blood sugar gets into diabetic blood sugar ranges. Mm. She does not. She looks like she had a glass of water. Like, her damn blood sugar barely changes. And so, even again, you know, we can use this starting place of largely whole and processed foods, but then you really have a massive amount of variation from person to person and how they respond to those foods. And that part, that personalized nutrition part, was the back end. It was the second bracket. On the front end, we had this kind of morality story of unpacking the misplaced morality and guilt around this eating, because it's not your fault. If you understand the way that your neuroregulation of appetite works, you can no longer vilify yourself or anyone else about the situation they're in. You know, we've got to have some empathy and understanding. And then we get in and start doing the work, and we understand it's going to be hard, but that's okay because the reward is worth it. And then we have this technology or this methodology for finding exactly what does work for each individual. And so that was really the process. And I appreciate that you felt like I put a little bit of thought into it. Like I worked on the outline alone for the book for 6 straight months. I mean, I outlined and outlined. And I feel like relative to the first book, like there was much more continuity. And also I was just able to kind of, you know, logic test, okay, does this feed into this and does that feed into that, and bounce that around to a number of folks. So I really did, you know, there's a saying I think attributed to Abraham Lincoln, if he had 6 hours to cut down a tree, he would sharpen his axe for 5 of those hours. And that, you know, to some degree, that's what I did. Like I tried to have an outline that was really solid and really comprehensive. And then I was just tasked with writing essentially like magazine length articles that were very easy to integrate and build on each other.
Yes. You had that wonderful little comment about the dopamine hit when you hit your word count every day.
Yeah, sure.
But you know, the thing is, along with the overall structure, and the way you connected all of the information, there are these occasional sentences that are just they've got 2 or 3 dimensions to them. One, it made a great point. Two, it made the point clearly. And three, it was funny. It hit a certain problem just perfectly on the head, and that is that the comment was something like, you know, we can argue about the nuances in the afterlife. In other words, sometimes, and this happens in the triathlon world for sure, discussions on certain topics can get so bogged down before any action's even taken or any experiments tried that they just, because, or they're arguing for, you know, and this goes like, I'll take barefoot running as an example, which, speaking kind of paleo FX, I was interested through Brian McKenzie on preventing injuries through treating running as a skill and using low profiled shoes and all that. And I was talking with a woman there who was a barefoot runner, and somebody that introduced us, and she just went on for 15 minutes about how people that were wearing the Vibram type sock shoes weren't barefoot runners. It was just important that I knew that from her, and I'm like, you know, at the end of the day, it's not really necessarily about what you're doing, but what you might be accomplishing with what you're doing. If it works for you, that's great. And it works, if what I'm doing works for me, that's great. And I think when you get into subjects in your book, like the value of community, for example, that is such an important topic. And in a thing like endurance running, where everybody thinks of the loneliness of the long distance runner thing, but my observation is that the happiest triathletes, which are typically the age groupers that do it for the love of it, are part of a tri club. They're doing it because they get to hang out with their buddies and go for long bike rides with their friends. And it was neat to see someone actually kind of bring that into this equation of what the pillars of health are. And you did that. And maybe you could comment on that a little bit, like what sort of key observations or experiences sort of wanted you to make sure that you put that in your book.
Yeah. You know, and again, it's kind of, you know, it's maybe on the one hand common sense, but I'm so nervous at using that term these days because it just seems so uncommon to have common sense. But, you know, this ancestral health template again was really informative on this. You know, what are the big factors in our lives as hunter-gatherers that are really, really different than what we experience today? And again, I'm not using that as the answer. I'm using that as a starting place to ask questions. And one massive area that has changed is sleep and photo period in our circadian rhythm. shift work was unheard of, essentially unknown until the advent of the electric light bulb. I mean, we just didn't do it because there was no practical way to do it. There was maybe a little bit of nighttime hunting or nighttime raiding or, you know, whatever. People, again, will get in and, you know, they're like, try to get you these gotcha deals. But nobody was working in a factory from midnight to 8 a.m. and then sleeping during the day. It didn't exist until, you know, the advent of the electric light bulb. And that's very, very recent. And so that sleep and circadian rhythm piece is a massive influencer on health. I would argue more impactful, more rapidly than food is. You could eat really poorly for a long time and not have it kill you. And Dr. Parsley makes a great point that the Guinness Book of World Records will let you jump a rocket motorcycle over the Grand Canyon. It will let you juggle chainsaws that are on fire, but it will not allow you to do an attempt at staying awake longer than the previous person who did it. And the reason why is the last two people who tried to push this out beyond 9 or 10 days, they died. And it seems to be everybody who does that dies. And we don't know exactly what the story is there, but if you want to absolutely break or cripple someone, you get them disordered in their sleep and their circadian rhythm, and the wheels will fall off the wagon incredibly quickly. Like, one of the most effective interrogation techniques will absolutely break anyone is keeping someone asleep for a while. You don't need to waterboard them. You don't need to shock them. You just keep them awake. And within 3 or 4 days, like, that person is going to tell you any damn thing that you want to know. And so the sleep and circadian rhythm deal is huge. And then, of course, we talk a ton about food. It's really important. And oftentimes, for some populations, the food is the only lever that they can really control. If we have a SEAL who is deploying and they're going to be in a change time zone and they're doing night ops because that's their tactical advantage, being able to use night vision gear and all that stuff, this is going to be the story of their life. But when they do sleep, it's better to sleep with something like, you know, some melatonin and GABA to help, you know, establish normal sleep versus Ambien, which causes unconsciousness and actually antagonizes normal sleep. You don't get into level 3 and level 4 sleep with Ambien. You're just unconscious. And, but for those folks, paying particular attention to the food can be really, really important because it's the one lever they can play with. And then on this other side, so we have movement also, which I won't talk a lot about. People are familiar. Usually, if we talk about ancestral health type stuff, the notion of exercise or movement is the least contentious thing out there. People totally get that. Right. But then the final piece is this community element. And there's been great studies, you know, looking at the blue zones and looking at different populations. And it would appear that individuals who lack adequate social connectivity are as at higher risk for morbidity and mortality as pack-a-day smokers. And when we look at the way our modern world is constructed, you know, we finish high school and then we move away. And so a 20-year process of building connections and relationships is largely torn asunder. Then we go to college potentially, and we've got a, you know, depending on where you go, you've got a 3 to 8 year period of doing your undergrad or what have you, and you build these relationships, and then those get torn asunder. And then we plug into a work environment, which people don't work at companies for 30 years anymore. You know, I think the average now is like 3 or 4 years at a given, job placement. And if your particular field ends up drying up in one part of the country or even the world, then you've got an opportunity to move and go elsewhere, which is great from an economic standpoint, but can be really damaging from a social connectivity standpoint. Like, it's just devilishly hard to make that stuff work. And this is where things like CrossFit or running groups or swimming groups can be really powerful, because you're able to tick multiples of those boxes. You get some exercise, you get some community. A well-run CrossFit gym to me is an amazing place, because if the coaches have any wherewithal, they're going to talk to you about sleep and circadian rhythm. Mm-hmm. They're going to have some good notion of what effective nutrition is. The exercise is kind of baked in the cake because, you know, it's a CrossFit gym. And then you have, you know, usually a very wonderful community that grew up out of that. And it's easy to underplay the value of that social support. But I think part of that is just because it's really, really hard to put that together these days. You know, if you work a full day and you sleep the way you should, there's not too much time left in the day for socializing, you know. And so you might have your own family, extended family or what have you, but it's, you know, sometimes hard to go beyond that. And in our own lives, we have young kids. We have, it's similar to you, so going out in the evening is kind of a pain, or having people over in the evening is kind of a pain because you run into naps and, you know, all that stuff. And so what we've started doing is each Sunday we have a brunch, and it starts at 8 a.m. and goes till 1 p.m. And we provide some, you know, core stuff for the brunch. And everybody else that shows up, you know, they're tasked with bringing something. So it's a little bit potlucky, but then if they have kids, then all the kids can play. If they don't have kids, no drama. The kids are usually outside playing. And what we've found is everybody loves this because we're not under the time crunch of getting done so that people can, you know, get the rest of their day going and whatnot. And that's been huge for us.
Well, it's funny. Part of the reason that I think the book really resonated with me is that my wife and I, we moved across the country just a couple years ago. And, you know, at the time we had a little boy, and now we've got a baby girl. And so we really haven't had time to, develop a social community. And of course we just had the baby girl, so the sleep part is off the rails.
Right.
We were both talking about, you know, mitigating some of that with what we can, food wise and exercise wise. I'm going to let you go, Rob. I really appreciate the time. The thing I want to mention is that I'm actually going to go through your 30-day reset and kind of report on it on this website. I'm getting my blood test. I think I've got it scheduled for Monday. So just so that, every time I've written about nutrition and diet in Lava Magazine or for Outside Magazine, the numbers kind of just go off the charts when we get into this territory. There's a lot of interest and a lot of curiosity. And I think showing what this process is like will be kind of fun for me to do now that we're kind of getting out of those first 5 weeks of having the infant and, can do a little more active mitigation. But anyway, again, the book is Wired to Eat. I'll have a review that, you can link to Rob, once again, congratulations on the book. I think you're definitely in the top 100 in the Amazon list. So I think, people are picking it up. So that's gotta be a great thing for you.
It feels really good. I mean, I was pretty getting a second book, and it was interesting going and pitching this to publishers because my first book was kind of a unicorn. Like, it did really well and continues to do well. First time author. It effectively spawned a whole genre. The space was prime, but my book was kind of the one that arguably like plowed the field for everybody, quite a number of people to come in subsequent to that and plant some stuff. So that's super cool. But both myself and everybody around me was very suspicious about whether I could do as good a job a second time. So I'm really happy that folks are finding value in the book, and the reviews seem to be really, really good. So yeah, incredibly tickled with that.
And final comment, if you don't mind, Paleo Solution, I think it's a tremendous book, and at any CrossFit gym I've been at, there's a copy somewhere that they lend out. And it's definitely been a guidebook for entry into this ancestral way of eating. But the thing is that one of the things I picked up on there is like, this guy has coached a lot of people, and he's been talking about this a lot of people, and a lot of people are like, but wait a minute, well, I really have to do that, or I got to do this.
Right.
I can't do that.
Right.
And, having done some coaching myself, it's an interesting thing. Sometimes you want folks to kind of like, hey, just relax. Let's just try this. And I think your tone in Wired to Eat is, as I mentioned in the review I put on Amazon, you're not on the top of some mountain shouting down how to do something. It's more of an invitation. here's some stuff I've learned, and we've seen some good results, and here's a way to try it out. And that's not easy to do. And I think it's going to sell well for a long time. But
oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Everybody from the Wolf household to Penguin Random House would be ecstatic over that.
Yeah. Well, hey, Rob, thanks so much for the time, and hopefully we'll keep in touch and talk more later.
Absolutely. Thanks, TJ.